argument from petition.
May it please the court, Mr. Brian Scott, is legal argument for petition.
May it please this honorable court and counsel, I would like to state some of the brief facts that are pertinent to this case and use as the leeway the Court of Civil Appeals opinion in regards to calling the petitioner Frank and the respondent Margie. Basically, Frank and Margie were married. They got a divorce, and in the settlement agreement, they split up their house, where each of them were to get one half interest in the house, but Margie was to live in the house while the kiddos were growing up. Frank is a lawyer. He got behind in his child support payments, and Margie hired a lawyer to file a motion to cite Frank for contempt for failure to pay support. And as is the custom in Harris County, when they went down to the hearing, there were a number of docket settings. There's a lot of people, confusion out in the hall. They went out in the hall, and Frank, who did not want to go before the court on the child support deficiency, said, it basically, is there any way I can get out of this? And Margie said, yeah, you can deed over to me your half of the house. That time he was $2,240, as I recall, back in his child support. And she said, we'll waive the May payment, that's $560, and then you increase child support payments by $177 a month so I can make the house payments. And if you'll do all those things, we'll pass the hearing asking for the contempt action. And Frank said, okay, I'll do it. I will prepare the deed and send it to Mr. Isbell for his approval as to form. Everybody goes home. There's no docket entry. There's no written memoranda. There's no letter. There's no deeds. Within a matter of hours, Frank called the attorney for Margie and said, I don't want to convey the house and will not do it. The motion for contempt was not reset. Frank proceeded to pay all of the back child support, including the May delinquent, all of which was accepted by Margie. And after all that had occurred and she had accepted the money, then Margie turns around and sues him for specific performance under the oral contract to convey the land. And in his pleadings, he also states or asks for the exception of estoppel by reason of the fraud, or the alleged fraud. The case proceeded to trial before a jury, and the jury, in its special issues, basically found for the plaintiff 100%. After the trial was over, and upon motions by the defendant, and also I might add, is of course, that she had also sued Mr. Isbell as an attorney for his alleged negligence as the attorney for not drawing up a deed at that time, I assume, or memoranda or something. At any rate, the trial court disregarded one of the special issues, and it held that Mr. Nagel intended not to perform at the time of his promise, in that the only evidence of that intention was his failure to perform. And following that line of cases, correctly disregarded that issue. The case proceeded to the Court of Civil Appeals, and Justice Brown wrote the opinion. Justice Brown correctly holds in his opinion that the exception of promissory estoppel does not apply. Obviously, the case in regards to the transference of real property or for a suit for damages for the failure to convey real property is barred by the statute of frauds absent some exception. Those exceptions are clearly set out by this court in both the Hooks-Bridgewater line of cases, which clearly does not apply here. Margie only, number one, didn't have adverse possession to Frank, and number two, she didn't do any improvements to the house. It was only a matter of hours that the promise was in existence. The next line of cases, which is, of course, the Wheeler versus White and the Moorburger-Phillips line of cases, in regards to the exception of promissory estoppel don't apply either, as Justice Brown correctly held. In those line of cases, one of the requirements is that the person suffers severe damage. And it's more than just damage that can just merely be compensated by a money judgment, as stated in the Clifton Ogle case, that where the lady had moved on the property and paid the taxes and made the payments to the house for something like 4 or 5 years. And the court held that was not sufficient detriment to come under the theory of promissory estoppel. In our case, what we have is that, in fact, Margie Nagel suffered no damage. What she did was, if we take a look at it, she agreed to pass a hearing without prejudice. There was no reason that she couldn't set the hearing for the next day if she wished. There was no reason that she couldn't have gone on and allowed the trial court to do whatever it decided to do in its discretion and under the facts and the pleadings. But what she did have was an arm of the law that was not intended to be used in this manner. And that is, that arm or that weapon was the possibility that Frank could be put in jail, a quasi-criminal action. And by the use of this arm, she was enabled to get an agreement out of Mr. Nagel to transfer an equity in a house, the jury found to be worth $21,000-something, as well as attorney's fees in the amount of $4,200, in exchange for the release of $560 worth of attorney's fees. That certainly is not justice. And equity would not demand that that be pushed and fulfilled. One of the very important requirements of promissory estoppel is that injustice can be avoided only by the going around the statute of frauds. In this case, what we have is that to enforce it, to enforce promissory estoppel, or to say that promissory estoppel applies, would be a great injustice by that effect and that end. In regards on to the opinion of Justice Brown, he proceeded in his opinion to say, after the promissory estoppel does not apply, he came back in the back door erroneously and held that common law fraud applied, reinstated the fact issue that the trial court had thrown out, and said that now we've got common law fraud, therefore she's entitled to damages against Frank for her loss of bargain, her loss of expectancy. This not only is an incorrect statement of the law, if the court's opinion is allowed to stand, it changes the law in two major areas. Number one, it holds for the first time, because none authority is given and none exists, to my understanding and search of the law, where common law fraud alone allows you to get around the statute of frauds. If that were the case, then it would merely become a matter of a swearing match on any real estate transaction, because the detriment is not there, the serious detriment is no longer there. The other elements of promissory estoppel are just thrown out the window. And all you have to have is an allegation and finding that a promise was made with the intent not to do it, and you can get the land or damages for it. This is entirely contrary to the line of cases and the Wilson versus Fisher line, Foster, excuse me, Supreme Court cases and those cases that are cited in our supplemental brief, to the effect that this is not really a fraud case. And if you can't get the land back under specific performance, you can't get the land, you can't get damages for the land. To get damages for the land is tantamount to enforcing specific performance. What you're saying is that it's a valid good contract and I get the value of the land. So to enforce damages is the same as to enforce the specific performance and to get around the statute of frauds. It's to change the rule of promissory estoppel from a shield to a sword, because the cases clearly say, as in Moorburger, that the promissory estoppel doesn't create a contract where none existed. What it did And what it was supposed to do was to allow in those special circumstances where those exceptions all were present for them to get back what they lost. Well, what Margie Nagel lose in this case? Nothing. She got everything. She may not, all she did was have a right to ask for attorney's fees, and she may have been able to get that, or may not have. That would have been up to the trial court. We don't know, since she didn't reset it. Plus, the court missed the point, even in regards to the common law. Let's take that step and say, in argumento, that common law fraud is an exception to the statute of frauds in and of itself, without the other elements of promissory estoppel being present. Then if what we have is an uncompleted sale of real estate, not completed by either side. This is totally different. It does not come within the purview of Article of 2701 of the old Article 4004, where the suit for real estate fraud, on those, the cases clearly hold that those are suits where there was a completed transaction. The land was transferred. The house was bought. And the property wasn't as represented, or the roof wasn't as represented. And in those instances, it's held that the difference between the value of the property as represented or the property as transferred plus the ensuing common law damages can be recovered. But it's not, those are not the situations where if you have a total expectancy. I would liken this case very closely to where the guy, the old fellow would be walking down the street in New York and a guy would jump out behind a building or something, so I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge for $100. And I'll give you the deed later, and he gives him, he says, great, I'll give you the $100, and he meets him later, and he gives him the $100 back, and he said, well, I've decided not to go through with that deal. And the fella says, well, in that case, I'll take the $100, and I'm suing you for $10 million. That's the value of the Brooklyn Bridge, and that's what I lost. This case is not a suit for fraud, it's a suit on the contract. The contract is what they're trying to enforce. What they're trying to enforce is his promise to convey the land. And you can't get around that by calling it fraud or by calling it anything else. In regards to their contention that this case is controlled by the compromise and settlement rule. Several things. Rule 11 of the Texas Rules of Procedure requires that settlements and compromise be placed in writing also, and that there are some cases which hold that in instances where everybody agrees to the wording, it can take it out of Rule 11 if it's just a verbal agreement. That does not mean that a compromise and settlement is not controlled by all the other rules and requirements of a contract. What those cases do hold is that a compromise and settlement is a contract and may be enforced as a contract. But that's not to say that that contract must not also comply with the law. And again, his authorities are not in any point to provide an exception to the statute of frauds in this instance. There's also wasn't a dispute as to the amount of the child support. The dispute was he ain't paid it. Now, I might also point out that the suit for the enforcement of the child support didn't have anything to do with the real estate. What we had was a suit as again for a money enforcement payment. And when the compromise was reached, it was then, okay, we're not going to reduce the amount. We reduced it by $560, and I'm going to give you the land. That does not take this out of the statute of frauds. It would be a lot stronger suit in the compromise and settlement situation if in this lawsuit we'd had a compromise and settlement and we'd agreed to on some lesser amount as opposed to the conveyance of the land, that would be a lot more pertinent and important than that one was. But that would be very simply about the same thing as if the fellow you sued on a note and he said, "Well, I will incur the indebtedness of another, or I'll convey you Blackacre or whatever." And that was not the purposes or the intent of those cases under Rule 11, nor has any such rule ever been espoused by this court that that's an exception to the statute of frauds. In regards to the attorney's fees, the trial court judgment clearly states that after the money judgment of some $21,000 is allowed by Margie against Frank, and then it says an attorney's fee is an amount of $4,250 or something of that amount. Well, again, there's just no statutory or case authority allowing attorney's fees as part of the actual damages for fraud, for common law fraud, and that's the only basis of the court's opinion. Now, I would like to make the point that, I mean, there's a specific case, the Hennigan-Harris County case, it's cited in our brief, specifically holds that attorney's fees is not a part of actual damages. Now, that's not to say if they were pecuniary damages that they may not be able to introduce evidence about attorney's fees if that were pled and proved, and the jury may consider that in punishment. That's not our case here. It's just a pure and simple, a special issue on attorney's fees. That was just clearly, blatantly wrong. To allow, yes, they suffered the damages of having the attorney's fees. Nearly every litigant in any trial does suffer those damages. But it's not recoverable as actual damages. In part, Margie has recouped already everything that she was entitled to when she walked into that courtroom that day that the oral promise was made. Justice has been served, and to do equity has been served, and the legal requirement in and of itself requires that the case be reversed and rendered, both in law and in equity. There have been several amicus curiae briefs filed in this case, which I think are very poignant and very good, by title companies, making the and stressing the point to the court that to allow common law fraud as an exception to the statute of frauds then just makes it a mere swearing match to control the title to real estate, and they can't keep up with that very easily. And for these and all the other reasons stated, we respectfully request the court to reverse the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Kent. Your argument from the respondent?
May I please report Ms. Joanne Story, which is an argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Frank Caton, who tried this case, has been ordered by the district court in Houston to attend depositions in England. I will be arguing
Margie. That's tough duty.
I'd rather be there than in here. I'm going to explain that the relief I'm seeking today on behalf of Margie is an affirmance of the Court of Civil Appeals opinion.
Counsel, it would help us. There are two lawyers, as I understand, counsel. Who represents whom, please?
I am here on behalf of Margie Nagel, as the plaintiff in the suit in the trial court, and whose position was affirmed by the Court of Civil Appeals. Preliminarily, I'd like to say that what...
Well, now, who does Ms. Townsend represent?
Your Honor, I represent Alan
Isbell,
the attorney in the case.
Thank you.
Procedurally, the trial court awarded damages to Margie Nagel based on the jury's verdict and also granted a judgment on NOV as to Alan Isbell, disregarding the jury's findings of negligence against Alan Isbell. Margie Nagel perfected an appeal of the judgment NOV to the Court of Civil Appeals, but as Justice Brown explained in his opinion, Margie conceded during her argument that her appeal of the judgment NOV need not be considered if the Court of Civil Appeals affirmed the trial court judgment. What I'm asking this court to do if this court does not affirm the Court of Civil Appeals judgment is to remand the case so that a determination of Margie's appeal of the judgment NOV can be had by that court. I believe that what Frank, and I will also refer the parties
Counsel,
as Frank.
Do you have a problem with Jackson against Eaton about bringing forth points in a judgment NOV?
What I believe is that that point was the appeal, Margie's appeal, to the Court of Appeals was never considered by that court. I don't believe that I had any error to assail and therefore had no reason to make application for writ to this court since I had no error of the Court of Appeals to assail. Since the appeal of Margie
the judgment of the trial court was judgment notwithstanding the verdict?
Yes. And the Court of Appeals...
Since I wrote Jackson against Eaton, it's been a long time ago, that under those circumstances, you had to bring forth cross points or you were dead.
What I'm explaining is the Court of Appeals never considered my appeal.
Did you bring cross points?
I brought a separate appeal. I perfected an appeal to the Court of Appeals. I filed a cost bond, and I perfected a separate and independent appeal, and I was an appellant in the Court of Appeals in addition to being appellee. What I'm explaining is the Court of Appeals never addressed my appeal or Margie Nagel's appeal of the judgment NOV. They never ruled on Margie's independent appeal of the judgment NOV because she conceded that if the Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court judgment of damages against the other defendant, it was not necessary for that court to address that appeal.
Did you not, in effect, waive that appeal? Was that not a conditional point on your part that would be waived if the Court of Appeals found for you another point?
I don't believe that we waived it. We were simply asked during oral argument if the court was to find in Margie's favor on the trial court's judgment, would that necessarily mean then that a consideration of her independent appeal as to the judgment NOV need not be considered? And I agreed, since they were not joint tortfeasors at the time, that there was no reason to. You can't succeed on two different theories against two different defendants. In other words, if the court was going to affirm the judgment of the trial court in Margie's favor against one defendant, then Margie was not entitled to a separate and independent recovery against another defendant on another ground. I believe that what I will also refer to the parties, if I may, by Frank and Margie, which is how the Court of Appeals referred to them, I believe that what Frank has forgotten when he states that his promise is subject to the statute of frauds and therefore unenforceable, and also states that it cannot therefore be the basis of an independent cause of action under common law fraud, is that his promise took two forms. One part of his promise, which was submitted to the jury, were the elements of the agreement. Did he agree to convey his one-half interest in the home? Did he agree to increase the child support payments by the amount of the monthly mortgage payment? And did he agree to pay the past due child support? But the second most important part of that promise, and which need not have been submitted to the jury because it was undisputed, was his promise to reduce his agreement to writing. I'd like to also point out to the court the facts that I feel are also important. I wouldn't want the court to think that the first time that this arrangement or discussion between Margie and Frank first came up in a few hurried minutes outside of the courtroom on the day that this motion for contempt was set for hearing. The record is very clear that Margie, on numerous occasions in the past, had discussed this particular proposal with Frank. She was constantly concerned with the fact that her home was possibly under foreclosure because of his failure to pay the mortgage payments as required by the divorce decree. She would come home and find notes on her door that said, "Your home will be inspected for foreclosure," and she would call Frank on those occasions and ask him if he was going to pay the mortgage payments. On those occasions, he assured her that he would, but he didn't. She, at some point in time before this contempt hearing was set on May 6, 1976, approached Frank and suggested to him that he convey his one-half interest in the home to her so that she could make the mortgage payments and would not have the worry of having her home foreclosed upon. On this particular set of circumstances, on the day before this motion for contempt for 4 months past due child support was set for hearing, Frank and Margie discussed on the telephone several times the possibility again of Frank deeding to her his one-half interest in the home. During that conversation, Frank told Margie he would think about it.
Well, now, is it your argument that these oral discussions going back to 1976 somehow or other excuse a contract in writing required for the statute of frauds? And if so, how much of this oral baggage can title companies and can deed records carry along with them?
I believe that what the Court of Appeals found is that in addition to the common law action for fraud, which Margie properly pleaded and proved, she also brought a suit for an oral contract to convey. And although Frank has set up this defense of the statute of fraud, saying that this, according to statute, must be in writing before suit must be brought, I believe the cases of Wheeler versus White and Moore Berger are controlling in establishing that promissory estoppel will relieve from operation the contract and prevent the promisor, in this case Frank, from relying on the technicalities of the statute where the action he has engaged in itself amounts to a fraud.
Well, isn't that argument available in every fraud case? Right this minute, there are probably 100 oil and gas transactions that are being discussed over coffee somewhere in Texas. And are those oral agreements going to excuse the statute of fraud because one of the parties backs out on the deal?
I believe that the doctrine of promissory estoppel makes it very clear that where one party has engaged in fraudulent conduct and because of the promise that he makes, knowing that when he makes his promise he will induce an action or a forbearance on the part of the promisee, that he cannot then, after having bargained for that promise, he cannot then back out of the promise using the statute of frauds as a technicality.
In other words, that's why the statute of fraud was passed, counsel. That people said you would and you wouldn't marry me or you wouldn't sell land or whatever. And the legislature, I guess in England or someplace, started. It's not our rule, it's a legislative rule. The promises like this, we feel must be in writing or they're not enforceable. Either they're enforceable or they're not.
I believe the decisions are very clear, and the decisions of this court are clear, that where the promisor, the person making the promise, the oral promise to convey real property,
there's several things in there. The old statute.
Out
there in the swing, everything was just fine. He said he was going to marry me, and he didn't.
Well, didn't the Court of Civil Appeals say that promissory estoppel did not apply in this case?
Yes, it did. The court said it didn't apply because one of the elements of promissory estoppel is that the promisee suffer what some of the cases refer to as a substantial detriment. But my argument is that some of the cases also hold that the detriment need not be substantial and that the case should not be made to turn on the fact that the loss be solely pecuniary. And I believe that the cases have held that where the promisee changes their position for the worst in whatever manner, not solely in a pecuniary manner, that is a detriment. That
well,
is now, an injury.
Now, Hooks versus Bridgewater is a form of estoppel, and there are three real tough
requirements. You've got to make partial payments. You've got to possess it. You've got to pay the taxes or make improvements on it. And what has your client done?
Well, I don't believe that the cases that have flowed from Hooks versus Bridgewater are applicable. I believe that the Court of Appeals properly held that Wheeler versus White and Moore Berger are the two cases on promissory estoppel which govern the outcome of this particular case. But I'd like to point out that the court in Hooks versus Bridgewater did recognize that the restatement of did recognize what the restatement of contracts says, and that is that the oral contract can be enforced where to not enforce it, where to apply the elements, the provisions of the statute of frauds will itself result in a fraud or will itself result in injustice. And I do believe that the court in Hooks versus Bridgewater recognized this not exception to the statute of frauds, but an independent ground permitting recovery by the promisee where they seek to enforce the oral contract.
Counselor, what is it on the theory of promissory estoppel? What detriment is it that the evidence shows Margie suffered, other than the fact that if he were in jail, he might get on the phone and get his law partner or someone to get the money a little faster than she got it? Is there any other detriment she suffered?
Well, she also waived the $560 child support payment for the month of May. And I think that if you consider the fact that most deeds recite for $10 and other good and valuable consideration, that in this situation you've got her waiving $560.
Was that $560 later paid too?
It was paid, but in her first amended petition, which was the pleading she went to trial on, she tendered back and had no intention of accepting that $560 payment.
Do you really think that is significant one way or the other? She was entitled for him to pay the $560, he paid the $560, and she decided, I want $20,000 instead, so I'm not going to take the $560. Would that be, how could that be a detriment to her to support promissory estoppel?
Well, I believe that it's part of the detriment that she suffered that day in the hall when they agreed to enter into this agreement. I don't believe that this particular agreement can be looked at in hindsight. I do believe that the agreement must be looked at the time that it was entered into by both of the parties. And at the time that it was entered into by both of the parties, she agreed to pass the hearing, and she also agreed to waive the May 1976 child support.
Do you have any cases that come anywhere close to this on the detriment suffered by the promisee sufficient to sustain promissory estoppel?
I believe that the cases that I've cited in my brief from H. Pelt Company says that the detriment that the promisee must suffer must not need be of a substantial or an irreparable nature. That
what,
it's
what were the detriments suffered in that case? What were the facts in that case that they say?
If you'll give me a moment, I cannot remember the facts in that particular case.
That's all right. Go ahead. It just seemed to me that I'm having a hard trouble finding something that she suffered, some detriment she suffered, other than she might have gotten this back payment a little faster had he been under the pressure of incarceration as opposed to going back to his law firm.
Well, I believe that that if the agreement is looked at the time that it was made, not in hindsight, when we can coldly review the facts and say that she was able to reset the hearing, I believe that if we look at it at the time that it was entered into, knowing that she had made this offer to Frank on the day before the hearing, gave him time to think it over, and it wasn't just a few hurried moments in the hallway where he explained to her he didn't have the money. In other words, this was a proposal made to Frank at least 24 hours in advance of this particular hearing, but had also been brought to him by way of a proposal from Margie on several occasions in the past. It was something that he had a choice over which he could make. He knew that that was one of the things that she was going to seek as an alternative remedy on the day of the hearing. That in other words, rather than go through with the hearing that morning, that she would accept in return of passing the hearing and accept in return for giving up the $560 payment, the promise that he would convey his one-half interest in the home so that she could therefore make the mortgage payments and not worry about the home being foreclosed.
Counsel, that sounds like one of the things that she was giving up was the satisfaction of seeing him go to jail. Is that detriment?
Well, I don't believe that Margie had in mind the satisfaction of seeing Frank go to jail. I believe that what her overriding concern at the time that this agreement was entered into was that her home was on numerous occasions in danger of being foreclosed, and that in her mind she felt as if him deeding his one-half interest in the home would take care and increasing the monthly child support payments by the amount of mortgage payment would therefore enable her to make the payments so that she no longer had the concern of her home being in danger of foreclosure.
Well, it wasn't her deal, really was. Look, you owe me all this back money, and if you just let me have the house, we'll forget that. And when he changed his mind, she took the money. Now, if she hadn't taken the money, or she'd immediately tendered it back, wouldn't your client have been in a much better position?
I believe that she did tender it back in her...
All of it?
Not all of it. She tendered back only the $560 May payment, which she agreed to waive the day of the hearing. I believe that the facts further reflect that